Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, the network for social justice. Today, we open our show with some national news stories from Public News Service and 2023 talks, including 9/11 remembrances, concerns over the growing political divide, a looming federal shutdown due to the impasse in Congress, and more top national news. Plus, hear about a battle over funding for WIC, the program that helps women, infants, and children. In local news, we'll have a special report on El Cajon's new license reading cameras, which are catching crooks but also raising privacy concerns. Hear about a deadly head-on collision in Ramona, a small plane that made an emergency landing near Gillespie Field, and a mouse that tested positive for hantavirus on Mount Laguna. On Crime Beat, we'll have news about a naked burglary suspect in El Cajon, the arrest of serial retail theft suspects, and the results of La Mesa's recent DUI checkpoint. Learn how Lemon Grove leaders are teaming up with residents to address blight, and how you can make your voice heard in a county survey. We'll also be re-airing our bookshelf interview with Roger Scholey, a former San Diego Union-Tribune journalist and author of several books on San Diego history. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, September the 11th, 2023. I'm Mike Clifford. Political candidates running for federal office have grown increasingly reliant on out-of-state donations. That's according to a new report.
Government transparency group Open Secrets finds Senate candidates from less populated states like Maine receive more than half their donations from out of state, with only a little more than that for House contenders. Research director Sarah Briner says social media is boosting candidates' profiles, allowing them to raise funds from people who will likely never vote for them.
You would just assume that people who are giving to candidates in Maine would be from Maine. That, over time, has become less and less the case.
Briner says Democrats are more reliant on out-of-state money than Republicans, although the gap has narrowed in recent years. I'm Catherine Carley reporting.
One example, after Susan Collins of Maine voted to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, out-of-state donors flooded her opponent's campaign with donations unprecedented in previous Maine elections. President Joe Biden will mark the 22nd anniversary today of the September 11 attacks in Alaska as he returns home from foreign travel, that from Spectrum New York. The president will be returning from his overseas trips to India for the G20 summit and his first visit to Vietnam since taking office. Biden will speak to about 1,000 first responders and their families at a military base in Anchorage, Alaska. Meantime, Vice President Kamala Harris will be at the National September 11 Memorial Museum in Lower Manhattan. Colorado wants to reduce climate pollution from apartments and commercial buildings 50,000 square feet and larger. But there is growing concern that retrofitting buildings could exacerbate the state's affordable housing crisis if costs are passed along to tenants.
As Inflation Reduction Act and other climate mitigation funding becomes available, Jennifer Gremmert with Energy Outreach Colorado says it's important to ensure protections for families already struggling to pay their utilities and rent.
We're optimistic about a lot of funding coming in, but really need to target it in the area where we believe the most need is, and that's affordable housing, buildings that are serving vulnerable households, et cetera.
Regulation 28, set to go into effect in mid-October, aims to reduce emissions by 7% by 2026 and 20% by 2030. Building owners will have some leeway in how they can comply and limit costs, and state officials will help property managers get information about grants and other ways to finance a major shift in how households use energy. Governor Jared Polis has also issued an executive order designed to boost affordable housing by speeding up project funding. I'm Eric Galatis.
Estimates are commercial and residential buildings are responsible for 13% of the nation's climate pollution. This is Public News Service. This election season, Indiana will have a new governor or perhaps a new mayor of Indianapolis. Our Terry D tells us one group is working to increase voter participation from Hoosiers with disabilities, who may sometimes feel left out of the process.
Beyond the Ballot is a nonpartisan virtual meeting coming up this evening. The goal is to inform residents about different ways to be involved in the upcoming elections. Kristen Dulaney with Indiana Disability Rights says the online session is an opportunity for people to take a deep look at how decisions are made at the Indiana State House and nationally.
It's so important for the disability community to feel like they're fully represented throughout the entire election process. We have the right to vote, and yes, we should make our voice heard.
The virtual meeting is this evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Dulaney says it will include a brief refresher on disability voting rights, how to be a poll worker, and ways to volunteer for a political campaign. More information is online at HoosiersVote.org. I'm Terry D. reporting.
A strike at a manufacturing facility in Newton is entering its sixth week.
Some 84 workers represented by the United Automobile, Aerospace, and Agricultural Implement Workers of America United, better known as the UAW, are on strike at Thombert, a large manufacturer of electric forklift tires. They've been off the job since August 1st. UAW Local 997 President Steve Wirtz says his team is striking over the same issues that typically prompt a rift between employees and management.
The issues we're facing right now are wages, changes to our health care costs, insurance. We are also dealing with vacation, trying to get people out of there for work-life balance. Those are the main sticking points.
Wirtz says the average worker earns about $23.50 an hour at the Thombert plant. I'm Mark Moran.
Finally, our Farah Siddiqui reports Michigan water rates have surged over 40% since 2010. It's a trend that's expected to continue as cities and utilities work to upgrade aging systems.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says people shouldn't be paying more than 4.5% of their monthly income for water and sewer services. But Monica Lewis-Patrick, who heads up We the People of Detroit, says water rates can run as high as 25% of some household incomes.
So when a person is spending that much just to access water, then we know some other things are being challenged in terms of their access to food, being able to pay their rent, clothing, medical needs, those kinds of things.
It is estimated about 200 communities across Michigan are overburdened with the cost of their water infrastructure. This is Mike Clifford. Thank you for starting a week with Public News Service, member and listener supported. Hear us on interesting radio stations, your favorite podcast platform. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Here in the Senate, we have proven there is exactly zero reason for chaos or for shutdown.
With just a dozen days before a government shutdown, Democratic Washington Senator Patty Murray says House Republicans should stick to the funding level Speaker Kevin McCarthy agreed to during the last budget crisis. McCarthy struck a deal with the White House this spring over raising the debt ceiling, but the Speaker now faces pressure from hardline Republicans who say they won't fund the government without steps toward impeaching President Joe Biden. Republican Representative Ken Buck of Colorado says they should focus on border security, crime, and inflation, not impeachment.
Time for impeachment is the time when there's evidence linking President Biden, if there's evidence linking President Biden to a high crime or misdemeanor. That doesn't exist right now.
Buck is a member of the Conservative Freedom Caucus. House Majority Forward, a progressive nonprofit, has announced an initial $20 million investment in voter registration and grassroots mobilization. The program will be focused on signing up youth and people of color spanning from Alaska to Pennsylvania. A special grand jury in Fulton County recommended Republican South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham face criminal charges over 2020 election interference. Graham joined former President Donald Trump's effort to pressure Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger into illegally overturning the state's presidential results. Graham was not charged, Trump was, but the senator says he still supports him.
I am proudly supporting him. He can be a handful at times, but I thought he was a good president. And I'm not going to be deterred campaigning for him and working with him.
83-year-old former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she will be seeking re-election in 2024 to address the challenges facing San Francisco and continued threats to democracy.
Our democracy is at risk when we talk nationally. And globally, people are concerned about what it means if our democracy is at risk.
Boston University social scientist Joan Donovan says social media algorithms are fueling conspiracy theories. Donovan told the conference Friday that a big part of the problem comes when disinformation starts in a social media silo, but eventually gets amplified via mainstream outlets.
A lot of researchers in our field will try to split this and say, oh, it's a cable news problem, or, oh, it's only an internet problem. It's a media ecosystem problem.
Donovan says media consumers need to be in a constant state of vigilance, and the internet needs to better reflect the broad public interest. Finally, today marks the 22nd anniversary of the September 11 terrorist attacks. The New York City Fire Department recently added 43 new names to the World Trade Center Memorial Wall, responders who died of illnesses related to rescue and recovery efforts. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Anti-hunger advocates are pressing Congress to fully fund WIC, the food benefit program for expectant mothers and children younger than five. Conservatives in the House of Representatives have proposed a budget for WIC of $5.5 billion. The Senate proposal is $6.3 billion, but Sarah Diaz with the California WIC Association says the program would need a billion more than that to be fully funded.
We would love for the House to reconvene and try to work out a budget that fully funds WIC so that they're able to serve all eligible participants and that accounts for the projected increase in WIC enrollment.
There is also the question of the food and vegetable benefit, which was raised to $25 to $49 per person per month during the pandemic in accordance with recommendations from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. The GOP proposal would drop it down sharply to $11 to $15 per person per month, which is slightly higher than pre-pandemic levels. More than 930,000 mothers, infants, and toddlers depend on WIC benefits in the Golden State. Diaz points to a report from the Center for Budget Policy and Priorities that found if the current GOP proposal passes, more than 100,000 Californians would wind up on a waiting list.
In the 90s, there were waiting lists, and that had a major chilling effect. So people will choose not to go to WIC if they think they're taking somebody else's spot, even if they really need the program. And that means that WIC won't be serving everyone who needs it.
Congress has to pass an appropriations bill or a continuing resolution by September 30th in order to avoid a government shutdown. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Cameras with license plate readers are being used in El Cajon successfully to capture criminals from car thieves to suspects in violent crimes. El Cajon City Council approved a pilot project with 40 of the cameras, which read license plates but do not recognize faces of drivers. On the first day of the program, police captured a stolen vehicle that had been carjacked in Lemon Grove during a violent robbery. The same day, the police found a stolen vehicle from Imperial County and arrested the suspect. Many more suspects have been apprehended since then in numerous additional crimes. The cameras are intended to reduce property crimes, violent crimes, vehicular crimes, and locate missing people. It will not be used for minor traffic incidents, parking violations, or immigration enforcement, according to a press release from the El Cajon Police Department. According to the city, information is deleted after 30 days if not used in a criminal case. The city also shares its data with other law enforcement agencies in California, though not other states, according to the city's Flock Safety website. A law passed in 2015, Senate Bill 34, prohibits sharing data out of state. Still, some privacy advocates have raised concerns. Jay Stanley with the American Civil Liberties Union has written a paper voicing criticisms of the centralized database of surveillance footage created using Flock safety cameras and similar systems. Nationally, over 1,500 communities use Flock safety's cameras. Stanley worries that this could give law enforcement the ability to track virtually any vehicle's movement. Verkada, a company similar to Flock, had its system hacked and surveillance footage was stolen, for example. And in some states, such surveillance could be used by police in controversial ways, such as to track women traveling to get an abortion, potentially. Some questions have been raised over the accuracy of the data, and several cases have been documented of police stopping and even mistreating people based on misidentification by surveillance cameras. Outside of East County, San Diego has gone farther with public surveillance cameras. The San Diego City Council has not only approved the use of license plate reading cameras, but also smart streetlights. San Diego is the first to implement both technologies. The controversy in San Diego not only involves privacy, but the San Diego Privacy Advisory Board not being given the chance to review the proposal beforehand. Members of the community have stated this created a sense of mistrust between the city council and the citizens, though others have voiced support for San Diego surveillance technologies to help fight crime. Metropolitan Transit System is also using surveillance cameras, and one recently helped solve a murder at a La Jolla trolley station after the footage was released to the public. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
A head-on crash in Ramona early September 4th proved deadly for one driver, but the other survived with non-life-threatening injuries. Both of these young drivers were residents of Ramona. The difference? The motorist who survived was wearing a seatbelt, while the other was not. The crash occurred around 3:41 a.m. on State Route 67 near Boers Lane. The 23-year-old man driving a Volkswagen Jetta northbound at an unknown speed crossed the double yellow lines, crashing head-on into a 2019 Toyota Camry. The Camry driver, a 20-year-old woman, was transported by ambulance to Palomar Medical Center. The Volkswagen driver died at the scene. The California Highway Patrol is investigating the collision, and Officer Jared Greishaber says this is an ongoing investigation, and it is unknown at this time if alcohol or drugs were a factor in this crash. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
An engine cut off while an aviation student was piloting a plane on Saturday morning, September 9th, in El Cajon. The instructor, Steve Mitchell with Blue Max Aviation, told Fox 5 that he took over the controls and made an emergency landing, crashing into a wire fence around Gillespie Field. A Heartland fire and rescue crew responded to the scene at Magnolia Avenue and Airport Drive. The student and pilot were the only ones on board the small plane, a Belanca Citabria 7ECA. And both walked away with no serious injuries. Charles Castle, 25, the student, said he closed his eyes and hoped for the best, adding, "We got very lucky." It is unclear why the engine stalled or why the flight instructor had difficulty restarting it. The National Transportation Safety Board is investigating the incident. The hard landing revives safety concerns among residents and is the latest in a string of crashes or near misses at or near Gillespie Field in recent years, including several that caused fatalities, major injuries, and or struck homes in the vicinity. On Facebook, several residents voiced concerns. Rebecca Leisenberry noted that there have been many crashes of planes coming in or out of Gillespie Field, adding that this plane could easily have hit a car with people. Shannon Cervantes said she felt frightened when she witnessed the plane come down while driving on the freeway nearby. Luis, whose last name wasn't posted, wrote, "It is really dangerous how low they are flying at very low levels all day. A couple of years ago, one crashed into a house and on top of a delivery man who died." He added, recalling a fiery Santee crash in which a UPS driver was killed. But others praised the flight instructor for preventing a worse outcome. Arthur Moir noted that there were no power lines down and no post-crash fire, with the plane landing right side up. He concluded, "Good job by the pilot." Reporting for East County Magazine from El Cajon, this is John Tidwell.
This is Miriam Raftery with a business report from Santee. Santee's Trolley Square will offer a bit of upscale shopping when Macy's takes over the now vacant Bed Bath & Beyond space starting in November. The city's economic development manager, Pam White, says Macy's hopes to open in time for Black Friday shopping over Thanksgiving weekend. But this Macy's won't be the same kind found in most of the regional shopping malls. Instead, it will be a scaled-down format that the national chain has been testing for several years and that has garnered some success. That's a big change from the flagship Macy's store in New York City, once billed as the world's largest department store. The Santee store will measure about 30,000 square feet, or about a fifth of the size of a standard Macy's. It will focus on best-selling merchandise, such as fragrances, makeup, handbags, jewelry, and clothing. Another feature of the new smaller Macy's is offering some toys through a contractual partnership with Toys R Us, but you won't see furniture, home goods, bedding, or kitchen appliances. While Macy's has rolled out smaller format stores elsewhere, the one in Santee's Trolley Square Center will be the first in California. Macy's operates 8 other stores in San Diego County, including La Mesa's Grossmont Center here in East County. In 2020, the company that also owns Bloomingdale's said it was closing 125 of its Macy's stores and laying off 2,000 employees over the next 3 years. Macy's and other big retailers are downsizing stores and bringing them to suburban outdoor centers instead of the more traditional aging shopping malls that are attracting fewer shoppers in recent years. Plus, Macy's company is using cutting-edge technology to drive the product offerings. In addition to tracking sales, the chain is using heat detectors to determine shoppers' interest in certain products and adjusting inventory according to what items are picked up the most and selling. The new Macy's is the latest change in Santee's shifting retail industry. Bed Bath & Beyond filed for bankruptcy earlier this year and shut down its 7 stores countywide, including Santee. The former Mimi's Cafe in Santee's Trolley Square remains vacant after 3 years. But on the positive side, the longtime vacant Hometown Buffet in the shopping center anchored by Home Depot will soon be getting a new tenant, a revised format of Chuck E. Cheese. The kid-centered restaurant is slated to open its Santee site in late September.
This is Jonathan Getz with a health alert. A deer mouse collected near Mount Laguna on August 24th during routine county monitoring has tested positive for hantavirus. Hantavirus in wild rodents is relatively common in San Diego County. This is the 7th routine detection of hantavirus in the region this year. However, because wild rodents naturally avoid people, human exposure to the virus is rare. Still, county officials advise people to be careful around wild rodents because there is no cure or vaccine for hantavirus. People can be exposed to the virus when wild rodents invade their living areas, such as homes, garages, and sheds. Be especially careful when cleaning garages, sheds, and outbuildings where rodent droppings may have released hantavirus into the air. Do not sweep or vacuum rodent nests or droppings since this can spread the virus. Instead, use wet cleaning methods with a diluted bleach solution or other disinfectants. But first, ventilate the area by opening doors and windows for at least 30 minutes. Then, spray the bleach solution or other disinfectant onto the area to be cleaned and let it stand for at least 15 minutes. Then clean with a mop or sponge soaked in disinfectant. Double bag any debris removed in sealed plastic bags, then disinfect gloves and wash your hands. Symptoms of hantavirus usually develop between 1 and 8 weeks after exposure. These include severe muscle aches, chills, fever or fatigue, headache or dizziness, nausea, vomiting or stomach pain, and difficulty breathing. If you think that you may have been exposed to hantavirus, seek medical attention immediately. For more information, contact the County Department of Environmental Health and Quality at 858-694-2888. That's the DEHQ, the Department of Environmental Health and Quality, at 858-694-2888.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is John Tidwell with a Crime Beat report. A naked man on methamphetamines walked into an apartment in the 1000 block of Redwood Avenue in El Cajon around 5:30 a.m. on Monday, September 4th. A young woman and several children, her siblings, were sleeping when the man walked into the children's room. Lieutenant Keith MacArthur with El Cajon Police says, the victim's adult brother was able to force the suspect out of the residence before police arrived. Officers arrested the suspect, 35-year-old Robert Young, in the parking lot for burglary and being under the influence of drugs. Young is homeless, according to Lieutenant MacArthur. The victims were not injured and did not know the intruder. A man and a woman are in custody on suspicion of being involved in numerous organized retail thefts. Kyle Dylan Grant and Tabitha Lynn Rhodes, each 33 years old, were arrested by the San Diego Sheriff's Department on September 8th in San Ysidro. Sergeant Heather Bruton says, "It is believed Grant and Rhodes worked in tandem to commit thefts from more than 20 retail stores throughout San Diego County. The value of the items stolen from multiple businesses is valued at approximately $24,000, she adds. The La Mesa Police Department held a DUI checkpoint on August 26th on Spring Street. During the checkpoint, which lasted from 7 p.m. until 12:30 a.m., 252 vehicles were contacted. 9 drivers were evaluated for impairment at a secondary screening, and 2 drivers were arrested for suspicion of driving under the influence of drugs or alcohol. Funding for this checkpoint was provided by a grant from the California Office of Traffic Safety through the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Lemon Grove's main business corridor on Broadway is the center of commerce, but the physical environment of the area is suffering. Community leaders recently took to the streets to conduct a comprehensive assessment of their neighborhood along Broadway, shedding light on issues such as drug and alcohol harm, blight, walkability, and other areas in need of improvement. This walk on a Saturday morning reflected the strong sense of community among Lemon Grove residents and underscores the urgency to address concerns through collaborative efforts. The Institute for Public Strategies organized the assessment and included Lemon Grove City Council member Jennifer Mendoza, the Lemon Grove Collaborative, the Lemon Grove Clergy Association, and local residents. The goal was to inspire community engagement and elevate public awareness around issues such as alcohol and retail density. The well-maintained spaces cleaned by the city stood in stark contrast to the vandalized and litter-strewn properties maintained privately. Working with limited resources, the City of Lemon Grove actually offers a cleaning service free to businesses, but some owners have refused the service and yet are not taking care of their properties themselves. The problems were worse in front of stores selling alcohol, but on a positive note, the area near Home Depot where day laborers await work was clean thanks to placement of trash bags nearby, showing that interventions can effectively combat blight and encourage responsible waste disposal. One concerning discovery during the assessment was the state of gas spot near a new apartment complex under construction where litter, human waste, and drug paraphernalia were found. Shorey says it's important to note that civic groups in Lemon Grove frequently perform community cleanups, but without active engagement of businesses and property owners, the efforts act as a band-aid for blight. Everyone, including the city, community members, and business and property owners, need to be part of the solution. IPS plans to present its findings of this community assessment at future meetings to educate policymakers on the issues. The assessment series will continue, encompassing other high-traffic areas in Lemon Grove. Shorey says, through these assessments, the Lemon Grove community is taking a significant step toward creating a safer, more inviting, and harmonious living environment for everyone. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
San Diego County seeks input on projects covering a wide range of priorities that may affect you, your neighborhood, or the region at large. Your feedback is wanted on homelessness, a campaign to leave no veteran homeless, the Climate Action Plan, and economic impacts from border water pollution. You can share your perspective by submitting comments, sharing personal stories, and/or taking surveys. These projects and others are all listed on the county's Engage San Diego County page, which you can find at engage.sandiegocounty.gov. You can make a difference with your feedback. Public comments and surveys help shape decisions on how the county moves forward on challenging issues. So weigh in and make your voice heard before the September 30th deadline. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, This is Jonathan Getz.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment.
Today I'm speaking with Roger Scholey, retired journalist from the San Diego Union-Tribune and author of six books, including three San Diego Memories volumes and three others on local history. My guest is also president of the Balboa Park Committee of 100 and serves on the boards of the San Diego Architectural Foundation and Friends of San Diego Architecture. That's a lot. Welcome, Roger Scholey. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Nice to be with you, Raina.
Okay, let's begin with your history. I know that you're a third generation San Diegan. You graduated from UC San Diego in 1970 with a history degree, and you've raised your family here. How did you end up as staff writer for the UT for 44 years, and ultimately your involvement in this series?
I was a reporter for the Triton Times at UCSD and was one of the founders in the 60s. And the university does not have any journalism program. So we had to self-teach ourselves how to be reporters and editors and everything else. So that's where I got my training. Then I was also a campus correspondent for the Evening Tribune for several years. And after graduation, I made my way to the UT as a reporter and started in 1974. And I've always been interested in San Diego history. Obviously, I was a history major, so that was part of my profile. And as you know, San Diego schools do very little in the way of history teaching of the local history. You only learn it in third or fourth grade, and you never hear about it, about California or San Diego again.
Right.
So a lot of this is self-learning by San Diegans. And if you're from here, you have more chance of learning about the past through your families. But for, mm-hmm. I don't know, 80% of San Diego residents, they were not born here. So they don't know innately what the place is about, which explains why we vote the way we do sometimes, mm-hmm. how we forget things that happened 20 years ago because we weren't here. And my favorite expression I hear from people is, when I moved here 5 years ago, Sandy was much better than it is today. And of course, you can hold by that 20 times for people who've moved here from one period or another. So in the newspaper, I took a special interest in covering the history of places and people that I came across. And then I started writing stories about San Diego history whenever I could, and then myself, because I didn't teach, I wasn't taught it either. Well, when I left the newspaper in March of 2018, as I was walking out the door, Jeff Light, the editor of the Union Tribune, pulled me aside and said, I have something for you to do. So he told me about this series of books by Pediment in Washington State. They have partnered with historical societies and local newspapers to do dozens and dozens of pictorial histories of their places and people and everything else. So I said, sure, I'd love to do that. So he came out with the first book in 2018 that took San Diego up to 1940. And then in 2019, I did the one from 1940 to 60. And this one that you're talking about today was 1960 to 1980. And then I have one more volume, I think, for San Diego, this particular series, 1980 to 2020. And I said, well, why do you go to 40 years period rather than 20? And the Pediment people said, as you get closer to the present, people don't think of that as history. They think of that as me. And I don't
right.
care about me because I lived through all that.
Right.
So I think that's probably one reason why we're going to pull 40 years together in quite a romp from 1980 to now. And I figured that one chapter was going to be about 2020 itself because of the pandemic. So that's the most interesting year in our lifetimes.
Yes, we are living a fascinating history. Before we talk about the book in particular, with your perspective as a longtime journalist and a history expert, What would you say is the biggest difference that you've seen in San Diego over the years, and the biggest difference in journalism as well, if I could ask?
Of course, the biggest difference is it's grown a lot in my lifetime. I was born in 1948, so San Diego was 500,000 people about then, and now it's 1.3 million just in the city, and the county itself is 2 or 3 million. Mm-hmm. And if you bring in Tijuana, another 1.5 million, that's maybe 5 million people in our region, which is much bigger than it was 50, 75 years ago. So that's the biggest change, I think, physically in the area. The second thing is that San Diego has become a lot more diverse in terms of demographics, with a lot more ethnic variety from a wave of immigrants who've come here for the last 50 years, which is very interesting. Mm-hmm. And then as this book told me, as I was trying to find the right pictures with the History Center and the UT helping, was the role of women in San Diego. So we went out of our way to pull out pictures of women doing all sorts of things. Same thing with minority groups, trying to highlight them, giving their due, because history is typically about white male, you know, leaders, and not much about the average person. So this book, these books are about the life of San Diego residents in all manner of speaking. So from arts to work to home life, everything is supposed to be a snapshot, series of snapshots over the last, in this case, 20 years of 1960 to 1980.
So literally the way we look at the world and evaluate it has changed.
Yeah, and then you asked about the role of the media and the newspapers in this period, 1960 to 1980. I would say that in 1960, the news was basically the Union and the Tribune. That was the main source of people's information about San Diego news. And over the following 20 years, the role of TV journalism has grown a lot more significant. They're not as thorough as the newspaper, but obviously, but people get a lot of their news from watching TV. And of course, that's not at all touching on the current period where it's all online and many other sources. But in those days, it was basically news people. Most people would take a newspaper. Most families would take San Diego Union and Tribune. And now it's many people don't take the newspaper. They get it online or they read other sources. So that's the big difference. I think the other difference in journalism over my career is that the idea of investigative journalism has become much more important than it used to be. If you go back and read the newspapers of earlier times, there was very little of that sort of thing, and analysis. There were sometimes columnists that got into some background, but the prevalence of investigative journalism was not really very active in San Diego until the 1970s. So starting in that period, when Jerry Warren became the editor in the 70s and was in the 80s, he specialized and urged us to be much more investigative in all realms of the coverage, not just big political scandals, but anything.
That explains a lot. Okay, well, let's talk about the latest book in this series, San Diego Memories 3, A Time of Change, as you mentioned, the 1960s and the 70s. You've told us a little bit about your collaboration with the San Diego History Center and the Union Tribune. Give our listeners more of a look at this volume. What's in it?
Well, there are 7 or 8 chapters, and each one has a certain focus. So let me just give you a sense of what those are. This is typically the categories that their pictorial histories include, but some of them are San Diego centric. For example, we have a military chapter, a maritime chapter that you wouldn't see in other cities. But we also, one thing I suggested we do, which is to lead off the book with activism, basically the political turmoil and craziness of the 60s and 70s. And in the foreword, I talked about that as well, saying the 60s and 70s is very much like what we've gone through in the last 4 or 5 years during the Trump administration, and a great deal of polarization and street, you know, demonstrations and sometimes violence outbursts. You know, it's just been, for those of us who grew up in the 60s, they said, this is just like it was when we were 20 years old. So
right.
This has been a rerun of historical trends of back then. There's also other non-political kinds of things in the book, sports, leisure, public service, transportation. I also wanted to do something on the seedy side of life, which is crime, scandals. We've had a number of terrible disasters in this period that people who lived here know all about. And the final chapter is about arts and culture. So we have there are about 300 pictures that are in the book, and we can talk about how we went about doing that, because it was a lot of fun and a lot of work, though.
How did you go about doing that? Tell us.
Well, I started with a timeline, because I'm a historian, so I believe in looking at history through time and chronologically. So Mary Mati Agudo, the UT archivist, has been keeping a meticulous timeline of San Diego history, starting from the beginning, and she's always updating it with events today and findings from the past that she inserts into her chronology. So I said, well, give me the 1960 to 80 time period. So I went through and I circled all the events and things that seemed to be reminding me of what happened in the news. And then we started looking for pictures along the same lines and tried to categorize all the pictures by these different chapters. And I think we ended up about 600 or 700 candidates. And then Pediment editors pulled out the ones they thought were the most compelling pictures. And that was about done in April last year. And then I went to work to research all the pictures we picked. I didn't want to do that first because I didn't want to research something that wouldn't show up in the book. So luckily I have access to the UT's digital archives back to the beginning. And so I was able to plug in an event or the date of whatever the picture was and find the story that's tied to the picture.
Wow.
Which is very much different, much more revealing than you realize, because the pictures the History Center has does not have any of that sort of information on the picture. It just says,
right,
seeing, you know, traffic congestion on Torrey Pines Road. Well, I looked up the picture the story that went with that is all about the congestion and that the fact the freeway was under construction nearby and that would relieve the traffic congestion. So there's lots of examples of that where the picture doesn't say 1,000 words. You have to look up the words to see the real information.
Well, I would think if you change some of the cars and the clothing, the picture might look similar to, say, a current time, but the explanation, the reason, the context is so different, right?
Exactly. Yeah, the details make the story. So I mean, sometimes these picture books that you get are not very revealing substance-wise. They're just a couple of lines about describing something that you can see just by looking at it. So I wanted to make this really a book about an information-packed book. So I hope people actually read the captions, because they're going to learn a lot about San Diego history by reading what the pictures are all about. So
it sounds like
I could have written a book about the San Diego 1960 to 80. Richard Perrault wrote a series of books for the UT back then, and he got into great detail. But after writing my other books, I began to realize people like pictures, they don't like to read, which is pathetic. But
that's another story, another interview.
So I wanted to pack in as much information as possible in these captions. And sometimes they went overboard and went to great lengths to check people's names and addresses, names and backgrounds, and even found obituaries of people who died who kind of revealed some information about them that wasn't evident at the time of the story, the picture that was run. And I've just found one mistake somebody sent me, which had to do with the Padres sometimes. So we do make mistakes. I tried my best to avoid them, but we did what we could to check everything out.
It sounds like a fun process overall.
It was.
Now, San Diego is famous for being called America's finest city. Do you have any historical perspective on how that came about? And if any of that is reflected, well, I'm sure it's reflected in the series, but what's the history of that?
Well, the phrase America's finest city has a very particular origin. That was the decision by the Republican National Committee to pull out the 1972 election or convention from San Diego over a series of scandals going on about that convention. So Pete Wilson was the mayor at the time, and his press assistant, Aldo Boss, a former UT reporter, wrote a speech about the what we would do as San Diego to counteract the bad publicity that came of losing this convention. So they declared America's Finest City Week for the same week of the Republican convention. And that phrase stuck, and it became, we had America's Finest City Week for many years, and Finest City Marathon and lots of other things. But parenthetically, actually, I should admit this, at that year, I was actually working in Washington, D.C. at the Republican National Committee. So I was on the other end of the news where they decided they had to pull the convention out of San Diego and what went into trying to quickly move it to Miami Beach, which is where the Democrats had their convention as well. So I was, you know, a big booster of San Diego, and I was carrying San Diego's torch in the RNC saying, hey, that's terrible. We should stay in San Diego. And of course they didn't, but it was fun watching it from afar.
Isn't that amazing how the slogan stuck? Yeah. In Memories 3, what is your very favorite picture and caption? What makes it your favorite?
Oh, well, my favorite is on the back cover of it, and it's on, it's on page 159, and it shows two kids at Comic-Con in 1976. And they're both sitting there reading a Howard the Duck comic book, which is really, but what I love about this picture is it tells several stories. First of all, comics. Second, Comic-Con, which is a San Diego creation.
Right.
And these two boys, one black and one white, sitting there as chums reading this comic book. So if you want something symbolic about San Diego's progress and being a diverse city and a fun city and everything else, this picture says it all. So that's my all-time favorite in this book. And when I came across it, I said, this is fantastic. I tried to find these two kids, but I wasn't able to track them down.
Interesting. It sounds iconic. Yeah. Now, the architectural boards and the other committees that you're involved in, do they inspire your work? Do you think you'd be getting involved with the same projects without the involvement in all those boards?
It grew out of my job at the UT for most of my career was growth and development. And so I was very interested in San Diego's growth and its buildings and pop planning of San Diego and architecture and everything else. So, one feeds the other, you know, and there's a lot of development type pictures I wanted to put in this book because that's my favorite thing is how San Diego grew physically. And so when I serve on those two groups and the Committee of 100 in Balboa Park, always being mindful of San Diego's architecture and the need to save pieces of the past, because if you don't have them, you don't think about the past. So there's been this book has some of that in here, some historic preservation mentions. And so in the 1960s, that's actually when the whole U.S. became much more interested in historic preservation than it had been in the past. And the federal government passed a law creating the National Register of Historic Places. And San Diego created its historic site board, and other groups like Save Our Heritage Organization were formed at the time. In our group, the Committee of 100 at Balboa Park, also in the 1960s, because while San Diego was rushing ahead in the 60s and 70s with growth and development and thousands of people moving here and building new subdivisions all over the place, it also had a very valuable elements from the past to save. And the Gaslamp Quarter, for example, was the association was founded in the 70s to save those buildings on Fifth Avenue downtown. And some buildings were lost, and we show pictures of that. Mm-hmm. But others have been saved or restored or reconstructed. So we still have a lot to look to, but we've lost quite a lot of important buildings, including the this year, the stadium's being demolished. You know, I mentioned there's a nice pictures of the stadium being built in 1965 to 67, mm-hmm. but the next volume will show the stadium being demolished. You know, this to me, that's one of the great crazy things about San Diego is we build something and 50 years later, we throw it away. Horton Plaza Shopping Center is going through right now. So this is history in the making. That's what, it's an American thing to throw away the past and don't remember it. That's good and bad in some ways.
Yeah, that leads me to, I guess, the question, why does it matter? Why is it so important for us to look back as well as forward?
Well, there's the usual statement that if you forget the past, you're condemned to repeat it. Well, you never repeat the history. It never happens that way. But there's certain things that come up in one time, and then a couple of generations later, we find it up again. I mean, this whole thing of right now we're going through with the Republican Party trying to battle back the QAnon people mm-hmm. Just shows you how dangerous forgetting the past can be. I mean, I was thinking, you know, now we know why Hitler was able to take over Germany with a minority of people, because the vast majority of Germans didn't take him seriously. Well, this is exactly what we're witnessing today with this whole battle of the QAnon people and the fake news people and all that. They just pick their own facts or create them or invent them. And if the public doesn't educate itself, they're going to be, you know, going to face some totalitarian results in the U.S. Yeah. In the rest of the world, you know, that they were surprised the U.S. came this way. But if you read American history, we've had this sort of thing happen over and over again.
Right.
From the Revolutionary War to the Civil War, all of our mm-hmm. battles have had this sort of conflict between groups, between regions, between mm-hmm. people, between generations. This is nothing new. If you don't read you don't learn the history, you're gonna make the wrong decisions, I think, and when you go to the ballot box. So I wish that we would have. Well, Texas apparently is a very good state for learning, teaching local history, state history, partly because they were a separate country for some years in the 1830s mm-hmm. and 40s. But California doesn't take any of that seriously. So there was a lot of talk and action at the state level in California in order to make people more aware of diversity and minority groups and their contributions to California. I'm hoping that effort broadens out to the general story of California and San Diego and other localities, because we could use a lot more real knowledge of that personally than we do now.
Yeah, so let's hope history finds its way back into all levels of schooling, yeah. Right? Yeah.
It never was. I mean, actually, it's never been a priority in the sense I'm talking about. So,
okay, good point.
It'd be nice to take that on.
Very good. I've got one last question for you. Tell us just a little bit more about what you're working on now and when we can expect to see it in print.
Okay, well, the plan is this year, which I haven't started yet, to work on the last copy of the last mm-hmm. Entry in the series, San Diego Memories, 1980 to 2020. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take in the same categories as we've had in the past. As I said at the outset, I think one chapter probably will be devoted to the pandemic year, because that is just an amazing thing that happened here and around the country, around the world. So just as we had an activism chapter in the 1960 to 80 book, I think 2020 will be sort of the opening chapter of the story, because even though it's contemporary, it's going to be something everyone remember forever, I think.
Right.
So I'm going to go through with Mary and start with the chronology of the last 40 years and start to pick out pictures. Now, the difference between this book and the last ones was the History Center had a wealth of 2 or 3 million images that we could draw from. They've all been cataloged. You could just go on their website and find pictures, and which I did. they don't have virtually anything from 1980 because their collection is mostly Union Tribune negatives and photos. So those were the four pictures in this book and all the other books, to the extent we had them. The new issue, the news book is going to be totally relying on UT file photos. And I don't have access to them at my home computer yet. I hope I can, because otherwise Mary's going to do all the work finding them. But it's going to make it, it'll be similarly organized by finding the pictures, tracking down the stories that go with the pictures, and then writing the captions to go with them. So I think they'll, if everything goes well, we'll finish this by in time for the holidays this coming year.
I can't wait to see it. I think it will be a fascinating enterprise choosing the cover picture. There's so many choices.
I've been thinking about this. And what is the, what is the one, and in this case, the picture we did in this book was John F. Kennedy at a pre-election rally in San Diego in 1960 during the presidential campaign. We picked that. I said, gee, what happens if Trump gets reelected? This will look kind of strange to have Kennedy on the cover, but it was a time of change. He was a new generation, you know, so that in many ways that was a very good choice for this book. But for the 1980 to 2020, I mean, there's so many possibilities, and right. It's somewhat inspiring, not a negative thing, but because we could have all kinds of pictures on the cover that are kind of scary,
right?
Or we could have something that's ennobling, you might say,
inspiring or hopeful at least.
Yeah. So I will just you could have someone with a shot in the arm or getting a virus,
right?
That
right.
A little bit too
right.
Specific, but we'll find something will come out. And what happens is Pediment goes through and picks all the pictures and puts them in the layout, and then they come up. They pick several of them as potential cover pictures, and we all weigh in on which ones we think are the best, and then they pick the one because they're in charge.
Well, if you need another vote, let me know.
Okay.
Roger, our time is up, but thank you so much for joining us. It was really a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. I'm glad to talk to you too, Raina.
To contact Roger Scholey, please write him at rmscholey, that's Scholey, at yahoo.com.
Oh, we should also mention how people can get the book, because it isn't available in stores. So they can get it online by going to pediment.com. That's the publisher. And you could write me if you want to get a copy that I can autograph. So you can send me a request as well.
Very good. An autographed copy for your coffee table.
Right.
This is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Corey Clement, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. You could donate to support our independent news station at knsj.org.